weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to Roz, Emma and Graham for driving us through the afternoon. It is Tuesday, October 29th. I'm Shane Dawson. You're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show of Beto Da Silva at 7 Bells, former Munster player Mike Sherry and rugby journalist Keane Tracy react to Graham Rowntree's departure from the province. Maeve de Burka joins us live from Tallaght Stadium ahead of Ireland's playoff with Georgia, while Mark Langdon wraps up all the latest European football news. And in Gaelic Games, Niall McCoy details the seismic shocks from across the club championship as all four All-Ireland finalists from last year are already eliminated. As always, if you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552, WhatsApp 0871879200, or we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Good evening. Welcome along to the show. Only one place to start, and that is why rugby writer with the Irish Independent, Keane Tracy, is sitting across me. Former Munster player Mike Sherry is on the line because Munster have confirmed earlier today that they have parted company with head coach Graham Rowntree following their disappointing start to the season. The Englishman, who had been under contract until the summer of 2026, leaves just six games into the BKT United Rugby Championship season following a run of three defeats in a row, the latest of which was a 41-24 defeat to the Sharks in Durban. In a statement, Munster say head of rugby operations Ian Costello will take over on an interim basis while they begin the process of appointing a new head coach. So Keane Tracy, if I come to you first, firstly, how are you? You keeping well?
Good. Didn't think I'd be back in the seat so soon.
So quick.
Yeah.
So I'd imagine that following up on that, this came as a bit of a surprise to you this morning.
Yeah, for sure. It came as a surprise, Shane, for lots of different reasons. Like, you don't often see a rugby head coach leaving their job mid-season for starters. On the show yesterday, we were talking a lot about Erik ten Hag and that's par for the course in football, but you don't see it too often in rugby. It happened last season with Ulster and Dan McFarland, and you kind of wonder maybe is there a culture starting to creep in of that. But yeah, certainly came as a surprise. I don't think anyone really had any caught wind of this. Munster only arrived back from South Africa yesterday and made the decision today. So, like, from the outside looking in, it seems like a very quick and potentially rash decision, but you'd have to assume that a lot of thought has gone into this from both sides. Obviously, the Munster statement alluded to the fact that it was by mutual consent. So whatever was going on behind the scenes hasn't been working. I suppose what we've seen on the pitch hasn't been that good this season. I think it's been a continuation of a poor end to the season last year. You think back to that quarterfinal win that they had over the Ospreys. They weren't that convincing. They were very poor the next week against Glasgow and let a potential home URC final slip from their grasp. And I think that that's kind of carried into this season, I think, a little bit. They've only won two of their first six games. And even you look at the two wins that they've had, one against Connacht, and Connacht probably would have felt that they should have beaten Munster at Thoma Park. And the other was against an Ospreys side, a poor Ospreys side that were missing so many players. So it has been a tough run. I mean, Leinster and Stormers and the Sharks away from home, but I think maybe the manner of defeats is probably what stung the most. Some of the tries that they conceded at the weekend were just so poor, particularly the try after 43 seconds. I mean, that should never happen, let alone to a team with the standards that Munster have. And it was actually reminiscent of a try that they conceded in the defeat to Zebre earlier this season, which was probably, in hindsight, that was probably the turning point for Graham Rowntree, because that Zebre side never should be beating Munster. So there's a lot to unpack in a chain.
Well, Mike Sherry, what was your reaction to this news? Did you hear any rumblings beforehand?
No, I'm very much on the outside now. I'm gone out of the setup long enough where I don't get any of this first-hand information. So, yeah, like Keane, like everyone else, I was completely shocked. It has not been a good start to the season. There's no getting away from that. But, you know, two seasons ago, they had a very similar start, if not worse. They lost five out of the first seven games, and they turned it around and went on to win the league, obviously. Now, they did pull some incredible performances and results out down in South Africa and on the road to get to that trophy. So, you know, they had that in them. So I definitely think that it's not just a results and a performance-based decision. I do think something has gone awry. At the minute, it's just speculation from everyone that's outside the group, but certainly based off previous performance, based off the fact that they won the league pretty much 18 months ago. They topped the regular season last year playing some brilliant rugby. I agree with Keane, the last two performances of their season last year were very disappointing. That Glasgow opportunity, a home semi-final following into a home final, was just an amazing carrot to have dangled in front of you, and to not deliver on that would have stung them massively. From all the noises coming from, you know, the little bits of information I would get, they had a really good pre-season. They had a lot of the group with them for a long period, including internationals, which they wouldn't have had the season before because of the World Cup. And yeah, it's just things on the pitch are not working. The defence is really worrying. Dennis Leamy is an excellent coach. You have players there that are very capable of buying into the defensive system and completing their jobs, and they're just not doing it at the minute for whatever reason. The line-out is a huge area of concern as well, and they're just lacking. That Sharks game was really worrying at the weekend for me. It's the first time in a long time where you were kind of half worried about players coming onto the pitch. The Sharks just looked like a different animal altogether. They were physically on a different level to Munster, and it shows and just seeped through the whole performance. And they're lucky to only lose by what they did lose by. Credit to them, they got the losing bonus point, but it was a really worrying performance for me.
The issues that Mike raised there in terms of Munster's game plan and the tactical concerns and the areas of concern there, like, they don't just spring up overnight. So, like, the timing of this, is it a case of he hasn't just been unfortunate with injuries and let's give it some time to get a few players back and we can turn things around? That, like, the timing of it, what did you make of that?
Yeah, like, I mean, we're in year three now of Graham Rowntree's tenure in charge, and Dennis Leamy's been there for the same length of time, and so has Mike Prendergast. Yeah, what I would say is I think there is a strong sense of deja vu when it comes to talking about the plight of Munster. We could be sitting here this time last year, Shane, talking about Munster's lengthy injury list. And okay, like, a lot of that, look, it's a nutritional sport, you're going to get injuries, but maybe they have to look at their training methods. And there is, like, a couple of things you'd hear. Maybe Graham Rowntree's quite old school in his approach, but they're going to have to surely look at that, because the injury list has just been crazy. And the line-out issues that Mike has mentioned there, I know it's his area of expertise. Mike, that, like, those issues were there last season as well. So this isn't a new thing that's cropped up. And to have this many issues this early in the season, like, for the last few games, they've had, like, Tyburn and, you know, Jean Klein, their first choice second row. And while, of course, they're severely lacking in the front row in the power stakes, like, they tried to address that by signing Oddie Yeager last season. But he's just been cursed with injuries since he's come in. And you had the prospect last weekend, or not the prospect, it did happen, where two academy props were on the bench, and you saw one of them, Ronan Fox, coming off the bench and had a torturous time in the scrum where, as Mike Ross used to say, he got his wings, which is not something, like, you'd have to wonder if it was even safe for a guy like that to be coming on against a Springbok-laden pack. So I think Graham Rowntree could justifiably say that, you know, in many ways his hand was tied behind his back in terms of, like, Munster don't have the financial clout that they had even up to a few years ago when they signed Orji Snyman, Damien D'Alende. That's just the reality of it. But I still think, and Mike has probably alluded to it there, I think us from the outside, but also internally, should be expecting far better from the opening, the start of the season. Like I said, two wins from six just isn't good enough. And I suppose just a quick point to touch on as well, and I was mentioning this to Marie last night, you know, Mike touched on the run that Munster went on back in Graham Rowntree's first season in charge. The turning point of that season was actually and Mike, you can come in on this, was the win down in Porky Cueve when they beat a South Africa select side. So I was kind of thinking at the start of the week where this All Blacks 15 game that's going to be at Thoma Park could be an ideal time to actually get a bit more confidence back. The pressure is off, it's a friendly, and off the back of that South Africa game 2 years ago, Munster won six of their next eight games, and as Mike said, they went on an unbelievable run to win the URC, and that should not be glossed over when we're talking about Graham Rowntree. He was the man who led Munster to their first trophy in 12 years, so he deserves a lot of credit for that too.
Yeah, Mike, your reaction to that in terms of the timing and kind of what Keane was alluding to there?
Yeah, all very valid points. I think in terms of, like, the front five and the front row in particular, like, you had a crazy situation where Stephen Archer wasn't going to be playing on this season, and then they recontracted him, and they're kind of going back to the well the whole time. And Stephen Archer's been an amazing servant. He's 36 now, and there doesn't seem to be front row players coming through. There hasn't been for a long time, and you've the likes of Stephen Archer, John Ryan, Dave Kilcoyne, Niall O'Scannell, they've been tagging out week in, week out, year after year. And while they've all been great servants, we need to see fresh blood coming through. You've had a couple of players come through, the likes of Josh Witcherly, Jeremy Lachman. He doesn't look a prospect anymore. He is an international player, and if he gets a run of games, I think he's a very capable player. But there's no depth underneath a couple of injuries. And to Keane's point, the training regimen, I've heard that it's pretty brutal. They train very much as they play, and it's very enjoyable. I've done that myself. I've trained like that while I was playing, and there are great sessions to be involved in, but it does have an accumulative toll, and your body tends to break down over time. And I would think that has played a part in the injury list, and it seems to be an injury crisis year after year the last couple of years. And without the depth there, without the power and the physicality, you had Orji Snyman, who kept getting injured. That was just unfortunate luck. And if he had been fit, he would have made a massive difference over the last couple of years, and maybe he would have been more likely to get another contract for this season. But that has had a massive impact on the pack and the feeling of the front five in particular being overpowered. John Klein having a long, lengthy injury as well. Just looking at Ty Byrne, he looks jaded, knackered every game, because he's trying to do so much, covering so many holes, coming up with big plays, managing the line out. I just think there's too much on him now at this stage, as well as being the captain. And yeah, look, the timing of the departure is very suspect. I think Keane's point about the South African select squad and the boost that gave Munster after that fixture, everyone, I think, was looking at this New Zealand fixture as a similar type of one to get over the hump, to load a few new players, to kind of, like the Maori game a couple of years ago, players that are playing club level, stepping up and making a name for themselves and being more than they are in the Munster jersey in an international fixture against the touring side. That's what the club is built on. So everyone was really looking forward to that. And yeah, it just adds to the kind of befuddlement as to how this happened so rushed and at this time of the year. But again, to Keane's point, they've definitely considered this or been considering this for a while, because you would hate to think that this is a rash decision after a poor start to the season. You would like to think that a thought has gone into it and there is rationale behind it. But at the minute, on the outside, I think people are very confused and worried about Munster.
I think the point on Ty Byrne is very true. He just looks like he has the weight on his shoulders. And I thought the way that the whole captaincy situation was handled, I thought was very strange as well. You know, Graham Rowntree was only last month, came out again, and he said that he did not have a falling out with Peter O'Mahony. Look, and we have to take him at his word for that. But certainly behind the scenes, you'd be hearing that it wasn't quite so rosy in the garden. And maybe his dealings with certain players around contracts, you know, again, it goes back to that old school approach, maybe didn't sit well with them. And I think, like, a lot of guys who are in that Munster squad, when they're going up to Ireland camp, as they are at the moment, when they're going in and working under someone like Andy Farrell, who you hear so much about his soft skills and probably how he's adapted to the modern game, maybe that was something possibly that Rowntree was slow to do. But how slow he was to appoint a future captain in Ty Byrne, when it seemed for all the world that he was a fairly obvious candidate, and they eventually came to that. But I thought that was handled very strangely as well. And you'd have to say, Shane, that there's no smoke without fire when a guy like Peter O'Mahony, a legendary figure, like Mike knows him certainly better than I do, suddenly gives up the Munster captaincy last November, it was, again during the season. So that didn't sit right, I think, with a lot of supporters as well.
On where to next then for Munster Rugby? I know Donal Lenihan was speaking to RT Sport and said Munster must be patient and get the right man in. Obviously names like Felix Jones, Ronan O'Gara are going to be immediately associated with Munster, and perhaps for reasons, individual reasons, they might be realistic targets, perhaps Felix more so than Ronan, where they are in their managerial careers. But before we talk about the individuals, Keane, is this a headache for Munster in terms of, do they want a head coach or do they want a director of rugby?
Yeah, when they hired Razzy Erasmus in 2016, they hired him as director of rugby, and they clearly had restructured their coaching staff. Now, when Razzy left, obviously prematurely, and went back to the box, they hired Johan van Graan as head coach, and they've stuck with the head coach position. Now, like, some could argue that that's just optics and it's titles, but you look at a guy like Leo Cullen, who is Leinster's head coach, but he's the de facto director of rugby. He's the guy who essentially keeps the squad happy, whether that's with game time or whether it's contracts. And that is a skill in itself. And Rowntree wouldn't have had prior experience of that because he came as forwards coach. So it's a massive headache, but like the Donal say, like, you know, patience. Like, I think patience is key here. Ian Costello has stepped in as interim head coach, and like getting him back into the system, I think, has been a massive positive for Munster. But his role as the head of operations is hugely important behind the scenes. But I think it's worth waiting for the right person for the job, rather than now going to the market where most head coaches worth their salt, Shane, are probably contracted, unless you're looking down to Southern Hemisphere Super Rugby coaches. I think it's worth waiting to get the right person a job. And if that means that, now maybe the next man for the job is in the setup, a guy like Mike Prendergast might fancy the chance to step up, and he's hugely experienced and massively respected in that dressing room as well. But if it means that Ian Costello has to stay on, and he does have previous head coach experience, he was with Nottingham over in the Championship not too long ago, if it meant that you were going to get the right guy in the summer, I think that would be worth it, because the idea of getting a short-term appointment now to paper over the cracks, I don't think will sit well with supporters at all.
Yeah, would you be keen to promote from within, Mike, similar to how Graham Rowntree, because let's be honest, Munster don't, they're not awash with cash as well, so they have to be very prudent and frugal with how they go about this next appointment.
They do, yeah, they do. And I would be a fan of from promoting from within. All the noise, all the chat back is that Mike Prendergast is an exceptional coach, played for Munster, grew up kind of in the Limerick rugby scene, knows the city and the province really well. He coached at club level, went abroad, got his experience there, and now he's back in the Munster setup. And the Munster attack, for whatever else were highlighting as areas of weakness or concern, the Munster attack over the last couple of years has come on leaps and bounds. I think under Johan Brengran, the concern or the query from fans is, why are we playing this conservative kicking game, forward orientated, basically South African style, when we don't have the physicality in the pack to beat teams in knockout games, and we're coming up against the likes of Toulouse, Leinster, and the kind of more physical packs. So that was the complaint that was thrown at Munster for a couple of seasons. It's certainly changed in the last couple of years, where we do have much more width in our attack. The ball is going through the forward hands, out the wing. We're scoring lovely tries. So Mike has brought that in, and all the players love playing his attacking system. So I think if he is appointed, that would be brilliant. I do think they should take their time. My worry is that Ian Costello now has been taken away from a job that was carved out for him, and as Cian rightly says, is hugely important. Munster needs to refocus on recruitment, on bringing players through the underage systems, on getting back connected with the club game and how we get players in through that area. It's Munster's strength in years gone past, where the club game fed up through the professional game. Now, obviously, look, the professional game since the early 2000s took over, and maybe the club game kind of got left behind, particularly in Munster. There wasn't that connectivity between both. But if Munster have any ambitions of being successful and winning trophies and having homegrown players, that is an area they need to focus on. And with Ian now going into the head coach role, in effect, for however long it would be, I don't think it's possible to do both of those roles. There was a reason why he was mainly off-field, probably dipping his toe in and out of coaching with underage teams and maybe involved with the A team and a little bit with the seniors, but no previewing and reviewing of games, which I'm sure if you talk to any professional coaches, the absolute bane of their life. They're at a laptop 24/7 putting together preview clips, going through individual performances, and he'll now be drawn back into that, and rightly so. A head coach has to do that. So he's now been taken away from the role that he was dedicated to doing it very well. And the worry from everyone in Munster is that will kind of fall by the wayside. By the time they get a new coach in, you're kind of picking back up maybe 3 or 4 steps back from where you actually developed it to now.
Cian, I mentioned, and I kind of brushed over it almost as well, that Felix and Ronan might be realistic contenders for individual reasons. You might just tease that out for our listeners.
Yeah, so Rog, I suppose, I just don't think it's going to happen for a few different reasons. Number one, he's contracted to La Rochelle until 2027. 2027 is the next World Cup, and 2027 is when Andy Farrell's current contract is due to end. So it doesn't take take a rocket scientist to put two and two together for what Ronan, what I would guess is Ronan O'Gara's long-term ambition. Why would he leave La Rochelle? He's got a great life over there, one of the best teams in Europe, like unbelievable squad. So I think the Rog to Munster ship might have actually sailed. I think he's probably gone past that. Also, he's coming back in and inheriting a few different problems, you know, that extend far beyond the pitch as well. In terms of Felix Jones, I think like he's an obvious candidate, but it's complicated. If Munster were to go for him, he is still technically contracted to the RFU. Now, he's seeing out some sort of gardening leave, and I'm not sure the intricacies of the contract. And
well, you would imagine it's going to be some sort of form of compensation that Munster would have to pay.
That Munster probably don't have. So unless they came to some agreement, I'm not sure. But look, everything you hear about Felix Jones is like exceptional. I know Mike would have played with him. He's still very young. Not that inexperienced as a head coach when you look at what he did with the Springboks, when you look at what he did with the English defence in a short period of time. I think he has all the makings of being a head coach, but whether he wants to go back to Munster, like if you remember in 2019, he left Munster after turning down a contract. I'm not sure like what terms he left Munster on. Would that be a potential stumbling block? But I think Munster would be mad if they weren't picking up the phone to sound out Felix Jones's interest for sure.
Yeah, Mike, your experiences of being in and around Felix Jones?
Yeah, I'd speak very highly of Felix. An amazing player, a guy to have around the squad. Unfortunately, he went through severe battles with injuries, but he kept battling back. And whenever he was on form, he was an incredible player. He swapped over to a coaching role pretty seamlessly. And if you know the guy, he'll work beyond anyone is capable of working. So he'd bring amazing energy, brilliant experience now that he's gone away. Worked at the elite level with South Africa for the last 4 years, and then in the England setup as well. So he would be a brilliant person to get back involved. I know Cian mentioned there he left in 2019 after having turned down a contract extension. But look, times change, there's new people involved. It might have been the right call for him at the time, a fresh break. So if he gets back involved, I think it will be a huge positive for Munster. I think he's probably ready for a senior head coach role now at this stage. He's built up a CV and experience, so that would be amazing. I would be very excited to get Felix back involved. I think everyone else would be as well.
Cian, is there any risk in that he hasn't been a head coach? I know he's got some experience in coaching and he's won, you know, the list speaks for itself, but just in terms of the actual title, because we were discussing that head coach department, director of rugby, and
that's the thing. It's like, it's what comes with the head coach role. It's the stuff that we never get to see. And that's why Leo Cullen, I think, does such a good job at Leinster, because he's the one who keeps so many players happy. Look, of Shane, there's risks with appointing any head coach, really, when you think about it. I suppose like the fear maybe from a Munster perspective would be that they get a left field appointment, as they did with Johan van Graan in when Rassie Rasmus left in 2017. And, you know, Mike kind of touched on it there. The style of rugby that they were playing under van Graan just did not sit well with Munster supporters at all. And I think Mike is right to point out Mike Prendergast's role in that. But I also think Graham Rowntree deserves a lot of credit, because while it might have been, you know, Mike Prendergast's attacking game plan, Rowntree also gave him the freedom to put that across. And that's not something you always see in modern rugby now. You look at Felix leaving the English setup for his own personal reasons. You look at Eddie Jones falling out with his assistant coaches. So that was, I think, one of Rowntree's strengths as well. But you only have to talk to people like Mike Sherry there, who's played with Felix, guys who've worked under him. Like, all the Springboks players would speak unbelievably highly of him. Anyone who's watched the Chasing the Sun documentary will see how integral, I should say, Felix Jones was to South Africa winning the World Cup. Like, Rassie Rasmus had him as his right-hand man, and I'd be very surprised, from what I hear, Andy Farrell is a big fan of Felix Jones as well. I'd be very surprised if Felix Jones isn't part of the Lions tour next summer.
Okay. And perhaps Paul O'Connell is another name. Listen, Mike Sherry, Cian, I gave you the first word. I'm going to give Mike the last word then. Will Graham Rowntree's tenure in charge of Munster be remembered fondly?
Yes, it will. Absolutely. As a Munster fan now, I look back on it as he's the man that delivered a first trophy in 12 years. He delivered a trophy for an era that included Peter Mahoney, Conor Murray, Keith Earls, Simon Zeebo, others as well. But those four players in particular, along with a supporting act, certainly deserved a trophy to go along with the careers that they had and the time they put in at Munster. The fans were long suffering, and that 2 or 3 month spell in towards the end of the 2023 season was an amazing experience, and to go and achieve what they did on the road and down in South Africa, it will always be looked back on hugely, with fond memories. I think changing the style of rugby, empowering coaches, as Keane said there, to bring in their own kind of flavour and what they wanted to do has worked really well. And he has brought through some young talent, there's no doubt about that. We just needed to keep on the conveyor belt when you look at Leinster and just what they're producing every year. Munster need to get up to that if we want to compete, and hopefully the person coming in will be supported, will be allowed to build on what Graham delivered, which was a very successful period for Munster, there's no doubt about it. So I think he'll have fond memories of the club as well. Obviously it's ended in a pretty pretty abrupt manner, but he loved the place. You could tell every time he spoke about Munster and Limerick and Cork and the interactions he had with the supporters. He will look back on his time here, 5 years, and see it as an enjoyable period that brought success.
Yeah, he was very open and honest with the media as well, which is a breath of fresh air. Listen, Mike Sherry and Keane Tracy, thank you both very much for popping in at the studio. Keane and Mike taking the call. Great chatting to you both. We are taking a short ad break and then we're going to turn our attention to association football in the company of Mark Langdon.
Game on.
Football.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On as we turn our attention to football, and joining us on the line is Mark Langdon, Sports Director with Spotlight Sports Group. Mark, how's the form?
Oh yeah, all good, thanks, Shane. Yeah, it's never a dull week, is it? The sort of the Ballon d'Or fallout, Manchester United sacking and potentially getting a new manager.
Yeah,
And it's only Tuesday evening.
It's great. Something for us to chat about, as is tradition with you on the show on of a Tuesday, Mark. Listen, let's begin with the story that has been dominating soccer headlines anyway today. Ruben Amorim learned how to become a football manager during an internship under Jose Mourinho at Manchester United. 6 years on, he is being talked about as the club's potential new manager. Now, Sporting Lisbon did release a statement earlier, basically, from what I gather, a statement for the Portuguese Stock Exchange to say that Manchester United are meeting or have met a buyout clause of $10 million for his services.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, I think all being well, Amorim will become the next Manchester United manager. These things don't tend to happen. That wouldn't have been the first step that they sort of got that deal in place with Sporting. United would have made sure that he wanted to come in the first place. I mean, may even have been United potentially were looking for a new manager from the summer when they decided to stick with Ten Hag. But it wasn't for too long. Amorim is a manager very highly rated in Portugal. He wasn't even at Braga for long when Sporting decided to bring him to the club. He's had a big success relative to Sporting's history. And they're doing well in this season's Champions League. He is very sort of passionate manager. He's somebody that, when he's on the touchline, sometimes you see managers and you wouldn't know if they were losing 5-0 or winning 5-0. Their kind of demeanour stays the same. That's not what Amorim's all about. He kind of, if he's going badly, he can't watch at times and he crouches down and he sort of paces the touchline. He's involved in the game. I think that United fans will appreciate that, at least in the short term. He's somebody that I think will quickly look to get a style of play and a philosophy at United, which has been sadly lacking really under Erik ten Hag. So those are the positives, but I heard you talking there about Munster and a new coach, and one of the guys was saying, there's always risks involved, and you can never be entirely sure how these things will work out, but he's certainly done everything he can at this stage to say that he deserves a chance, I think, at a club like Manchester United.
Far be it for me to be a cynic, but is the conversation going to be framed now, Mark, of, oh, is this young manager that has coached in Europe good enough to step up to Manchester United and manage in the Premier League because of how Manchester United is framed in the media? Whereas I know he was heavily linked with Liverpool after Jurgen Klopp's decision to leave, linked with even to take over from Pep. And if he was going in that direction, then it would be a case of this bright, young, great new manager is going to come in with all these revolutionary ideas that he's already starting off in the back foot.
Yeah, I suppose so. He was also linked with Tottenham before Postecoglou went there. So I think he's been on the radar for a while. But, I mean, when Arne Slot arrived at Liverpool, I don't think there was that much fanfare around he's replacing Jurgen Klopp. He was like, well, you know, he's done well in the Netherlands, but that doesn't really equate to much. I think probably the cynicism as far as United comes from is the fact that everything they've tried basically since Ferguson sort of retired has failed to work. You know, they've gone down the kind of really expensive experience route in Mourinho and Louis van Gaal. They've tried the kind of the guy that had been solid in the Premier League in David Moyes. I think Erik ten Hag probably fit into kind of this Amorim appointment. If we'd have been speaking about this a couple of years ago, I'd have probably said the same things about Erik ten Hag, you know, how well he'd done at Ajax, how he deserves this opportunity at a bigger club, how he had a style of play, and it never worked out for him at all. I mean, he did win two trophies, but I think most people are looking beyond that, and you know, the philosophy wasn't there. Almost felt like he was on the back foot. They lost those first two games, didn't they, against, was it Brighton and Brentford? And he, from that moment onwards, he very rarely looked entirely comfortable in the United dugout. So I'm really interested to see whether Amorim can cope with the extra demands and pressures that come with being a Manchester United manager if he does get the job, because I think that's the biggest unknown. Sporting are a big club in Portugal. You could argue they're not even the biggest club in Lisbon, because you know Benfica would lay claim to that. But yeah, they're a big club, but there's sort of Sporting and then there's Manchester United, and they are on a completely different level. I think the hope for Amorim would be that I think expectations are pretty low at the moment, and you know, for all that Ten Hag didn't get it right, the fans stuck by him, by and large. So I think that there will be an opportunity for Amorim to bed in, and he plays a back three currently with Sporting. I mean, I'm not saying he's completely married to that formation, and he'll play a back three with United. But when I look at the United squad, I do see the potential to play with a back three. I think they've got the centre halves, Lisandro Martinez, De Ligt, Harry Maguire, as potentially the three that might be sort of first choice potentially at the moment, can all play definitely in a back three. The fullbacks, if you're looking at Dalot and Luke Shaw, I know he's injured again, but I think that they're sort of made for the wing back role. So I think that there are reasons to be positive for Manchester United. It's not been a very good season. But if Amorim comes in, I think he just raises hope that he can be that person to get it right at United.
Mm. A 3-4-3 formation, playing in a low block with attacking wing-backs pushing up high the pitch. Off the ball, they press aggressively and counter-attack quickly when in possession. As it best looks at Ruben now going into the Man United dressing room and encouraging and making sure all of those players will have that hunger and desire. And that's another thing about trying to get that mentality out of certain individuals that has been lacking within that dressing room, Mark.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's always hard from the outside to know exactly how much of that was Ten Hag kind of ruining the team spirit and actually the players, just not being professional enough at times and throwing it in. You'd hope that United's players will kind of knuckle down and put the work in for the new manager. I think that I tend to think that the players maybe, and I'm saying this from the outside, but I think the players didn't agree with what Ten Hag was trying to do and could see flaws in it. And, you know, if you don't get buy-in at that level, then the whole thing just falls apart. So I think Amorim maybe has to show kind of, look, this is the way we're going to play, and if you do this, you know, these are the results you're going to get. I remember when Pochettino first arrived at Tottenham, he said to them players, you know, it's not about working harder, it's about working smarter, and if we kind of all move together, you know, you'll see the results. And yeah, at United, the team definitely doesn't move together. You know, the midfield does what it wants, the defence does what it wants, and so does the strikers. So I think sort of getting that buy-in will be important. But there's still good players at Manchester United. I look through that squad list, and you know, most managers, I think, would still be excited by the potential to manage that team. And they've spent a lot of money. They've got a really expensive wage bill. It's about somebody being given that time, really, to you know, to bed it all together. And maybe Amorim's that person, maybe he's not. But you know, I think he's well qualified to have a good go at it, at least.
We shall see. Other news, last night, the Ballon d'Or. Injustice, say Brazilian journalists and politicians. Real Madrid snubbed the whole event because Rodri won the men's Ballon d'Or. Did I have a point of all this pontificating protests?
I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I think for most people in sort of, certainly in Europe, like the Ballon d'Or doesn't have the same, I suppose, glamour as what it does in Brazil. It's a really big thing in Brazil. So, you know, there is a sort of, almost a natural, a sort of national injustice here for Vinicius not winning it. He was so certain he was going to win. Apparently there was a party planned. He was buying presents for all of his teammates. Real Madrid had like a five-hour show on their TV dedicated to the Ballon d'Or that suddenly got pulled at the last minute. I think he has a point, in as much as if you were asking kind of who's been the best individual, the most exciting player in sort of the Champions League and sort of the European leagues over the last year or so, that answer, I think, is Vinicius Junior. But Rodri was part of a Manchester City team that's just won the Premier League again. He then went to the Euros, won that competition with Spain. He was you know, hugely influential in the tournament, despite getting injured in the final. He's not the type of player that usually wins the Ballon d'Or. You know, usually it does go to that individual. And, you know, I tend to think that the Ballon d'Or is a bit of a joke, really, and that football's a team game, and, you know, you just should be able to sort of celebrate team success rather than individual success. So I think Vinicius has got a point in that he's been the most exciting player, but, you know, Rodri has been hugely influential. So I don't know if that's sitting on the fence enough, but I certainly don't think he should be crying. I don't think Real Madrid should have been quite as angry as what they were.
I think the big loser here is Carlo Ancelotti, who could not accept the Men's Coach of the Year award. Kylian Mbappe was not there to take his share of the Gerd Müller trophy alongside Harry Kane. So, listen, if you're that way inclined, or if you rely on that much recognition for Ballon d'Or, listen, you've still got a few trophies around, medals around your neck as well. Listen, Mark Langdon, we're going to leave the conversation there. Great chatting as always. We are going to continue our football conversation because Maeve de Burke is at Tallaght Stadium for Ireland against Georgia, the semi-final second leg playoff. Maeve, this tie is all but done, really. So this evening is a case of not getting any complacency, not letting any unthinkable shock of seismic proportions creep into this Irish team, and also then a chance for a couple of players to perhaps put their hand up for selection for a playoff final, so Eileen Gleeson might tinker with the team selection.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. Brosnan is obviously back in goals there, as we expected, and then you're right in that the likes of Stapleton, who gets a star tonight, I think she's, you know, there's a lot of expectation on her now because she really does have a chance to stake her claim for the playoffs going forward, either against Wales or Slovakia, and then Shiva too. She did really well when she came on the last night, I thought, so she's in instead of Lily Ag. It'll be interesting to see her and see actually where they're positioned as well. I'd imagine that Stapleton will start in the centre of midfield, and then Shiva, I expect she might be up alongside Caruso up top, but we'll just have to wait and see when they line out.
A large crowd is expected, albeit it is a dead rubber, which is great of a Tuesday night. And the experience of a big match atmosphere is sure to serve Ireland well ahead of bigger tasks to come against possibly Wales or Slovakia.
That's it, exactly. You can just see, actually, the girls are just starting to come out here and tell for the warm-up, and there's already cheers going around, so the crowd is definitely filling in. I'd say it'll be close to full. Obviously, it is sold out, but sometimes people don't come and fill the seats, so it'll be, I'd say it'll be an electric atmosphere, because we'd be all expecting some goals, and, you know, especially the young fans, they love to see a lot of goals from the girls tonight.
Are you expecting that then? Because Ireland were frustrated somewhat before the floodgates opened in Tbilisi, but 6-0 is fairly comprehensive, so you would imagine it's going to be more the same this evening.
Yeah, I'd expect so, but obviously they kept a clean sheet for the first half an hour, and Ireland did struggle to break them down. They were solid defensively in the opening half an hour, like I said, but then it was just, I think, the fitness and just the probing of the Irish girls, you know, for 90 minutes it's very hard to withstand that kind of pressure. We've been in that situation on the flip side before, often in the past, and, you know, you can only hold out sometimes for so long. So, yeah, I'd expect them to try to maybe improve on the start, hopefully get an early goal, and that'll kind of settle into the game as well, and you know, bring a bit of confidence to the attacking players.
There is going to be an eye on the other tie, as I mentioned, Wales and Slovakia. Fionn Morgan's late goal for Wales in the first leg gives them hopes of progression, with Slovakia now only holding a narrow 2-1 lead ahead of this evening's return in Cardiff. The winners will face Ireland in December, if Ireland do get over Georgia. I am being somewhat presumptuous, but it is 6-0 aggregate, as we have mentioned. Who would you rather face, Maeve?
Personally, I think Slovakia, we've played them in the past and done well against them. Wales can be a bit of a banana skin, you know, we would be favourites regardless of who we're playing, but I think there's about 20 or so places between both of those. Wales are 29th in the world at the moment, so and Slovakia far behind that. So I think Slovakia would be the more favourable draw, but regardless, even if Wales do overturn their deficit tonight, I think we'll still go into that playoff full of confidence, I think.
Okay, great stuff. Maeve de Burke, thank you so much for joining us from Talla Stadium. Live commentary on the radio on RTE Radio 1 Extra and on television, RTE 2 Television, and the RTE player of the sold-out fixture in Talla Stadium, Ireland against Georgia. Ireland have a 6-0 lead on aggregate against Georgia. So if you do tune in, I'm sure you're going to hear or view a couple of goals of a Tuesday evening. We are taking another short break, and then Niall McCoy of RTE Sport is on the line to chat club championship, because there were some pretty big shocks over the weekend.
Game on.
GAA.
Now, it's just 10 short months since Glen, St. Bridget, St. Thomas's and O'Loughlin Gaels rolled into Croke Park and delivered two classic All-Ireland club finals, capped off by a couple of one-point wins. But not a single one of that quartet has managed to retain their county championship, let alone look forward to a provincial defence and possible All-Ireland glory, writes Niall McCoy of RTE Sport, who joins us on the line now. Niall, there has been some big shocks over the weekend. What was the most shocking to you?
Shane, I don't know. I was at those finals, and to say that none of those four teams would come out of county, I would never would have believed you. The biggest shock, I would say, would probably be up in Derry. Newbridge, I've been punching about the top four in Derry for a couple of years now, a fine team. But I think given how impressive Glen were, especially in the semi-final last year in the mist in Newry, maybe they didn't hit the heights in the final, but they got the job done. To see Glen beaten, going for four in a row, I think was probably the biggest surprise. No doubt, for me, the most impressive, though, and that was Thomastown in Kilkenny, like to win by 11 points, having won an intermediate last year, is just so good. And the Donnellys have been doing all season, scoring heavily. That's the most impressive, Derry, the most shocking. But overall, just it's such an unusual occurrence. It's 50 years in the All-Ireland Club Series, and it's only the fifth time it's actually happened, the first time since 2006. I actually think it's the most significant one too, Shane, because, you know, if you look at the way the club game's gone over the last decade, we're seeing a lot of domination. So I actually looked at the football championships recently, and in 20 of the 32 counties, one team had won at least five of the last 10. And in many counties, there's a lot more, your Scotstowns, your Kilcoos, your Corrigans, your Turlestrands, and different teams like that. So maybe back in the day, it was a bit more, you know, regular, but to see it happening with those four exceptional teams really caught me out.
You mentioned it's not the first time. I mean, you did some digging, and it's a great article. I would implore anyone to go onto the RTE Sport website. It's in the GAA section on the stories about the shocks of the past, really. And when you were doing your research, now, what stood out really then from those shocks of the past?
Yeah, well, I suppose there's different aspects of it. Seeing there's like there's a couple of asterisks. Like you take Lavi in 91 who won the football and then were beaten by Dungiven the next year. But you could look and see Lavi were a dual team. They won the Derry Championship that year, three in a row. So maybe, you know, that comes into play. You look at Newton Shandrum, were out 6 weeks later after winning the 0-4 to beat Dunleigh. They're out in the Championship 6 weeks later and lost to Cork AT. Now they had a back door, but it just never got going again. So it's funny, like, it's such a long season. And maybe that plays a big part. These teams are playing, well, they're only playing the February, late January now, where they were playing in March, obviously. But, you know, maybe that's the impact. And again, I'll go back to Thomastown. They won the All-Ireland Intermediate last year. So there's no, that excuse can't be used in Kilkenny against O'Loughlin Gales because they had an equally long season. But it's hard to put the finger on it, Shane. It's just, I suppose it just reaffirms club football and hurling and just how many stories that seem to get on a weekly basis. It's just week after week, there seems to be headlines that just catch the eye, an unbelievable story, something that you really didn't expect. And obviously, there over the Saturday and Sunday, we had probably one of the most unexpected weekends I've ever had in the club calendar.
Yeah, Thomastown, as you mentioned, intermediate champions now, which is still a fairly decent level in Kilkenny.
Of course.
To be fair, but I think it was Tinnahealy first club title in 40 odd years as well. Fecal in Clare, it's been a long time coming. Osn O'Malley was on the show not too long ago with Coolans, their first ever, and I think it's the 29th different club in Dublin off the top of my head as well. But they're like Capitagal as well, knocking out St Thomas's and getting to their first final as well. It's genuinely a year of an underdog.
Yeah, it is. It is doing there, obviously having such a good result too. It is, and I don't know what's inspiring it. I don't know if there's any correlation. I don't think there's any correlation. I don't know. Maybe it's Armagh led the way, but what they've done at county level, how unexpected that was, and clubs are just maybe following suit. Putting the finger on it, seeing, it's very hard to do. Hard to do. But what it will do in all those counties, well, should make a lot of other clubs sit up and take notice and say, well, if Newbridge can win, Newbridge is an excellent team, but, you know, teams will be looking, seeing if Newbridge can do it, they've shown that it can be done, and different teams like that, Thomastown, such incredible progress in such a short time, they've showed what can be done. You're hoping across the country that other clubs now will be inspired by these stories, and again, we're going to see more and more of this, because it has been, you know, it's been near 20 years since we've seen this, where the four All-Ireland finalists haven't gone outside the county, so it isn't something that happens every day, but you're just hoping now that moving forward is something we might see a wee bit more, because everyone sees competitive club scene. It's just really exciting.
Does it show also how difficult it is to go back to back in an era where club football, the standard of club football and indeed hurling, is just rising, not to inter-county levels, but to be playing senior level at any club across the country? It takes a lot of devotion, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of skill and effort as well, so it just shows you how difficult it is to maintain that.
Yeah, it's obviously a lot of effort. I would actually argue that the teams that have been winning have been just showing not how easy it's been, but they've been so professional about going back to back and putting these runs together. Like, as I say, over the last 10 years, there's always been stories of domination. Crosswick Lane, obviously, famously 19 out of 20 in Armagh. You know, St Gall's in Antrim won, I think it was 12 and 13 at one stage. You know, Nemo Rangers, different teams like that. There was always stories of domination, but it's just become so more pronounced over this last decade, where so many counties, there's been a dominant force, and there's just no way of getting past them. So I actually think these winning teams they're just being unleashed and moving to a higher level by winning, and it's just getting harder and harder in a lot of counties. And that's why this weekend really did catch me, because for a few previous weeks, you're looking at, say, Kilcoo and Down, who look further away from any team. They look further clear. It's 12 and 13 for Kilcoo now, but they look further clear than any Down team than they have been probably in that run. So we're talking they could realistically add another 5 or 6 over the next couple of years. So I actually think these clubs that are regularly winning are just taking it to the next level and has confidence and momentum. But then again, as I say, this weekend, you know, shook me with the results, like, and I love seeing it. I love not the more to going on Sports Mail on the Monday morning and going through the photos of the likes of what happened up at Celtic Park and different places like that, because it's just unbridled joy, and to see families and the tears and all that, it's just so inspirational.
It most certainly is. On that most positive note, Niall McCoy of RT Sport, thank you so much for taking the call on that. As I mentioned, there is an article on the RT Sport website detailing all of the upsets over the years as well. It's a great read, to be fair. Okay, Sinead, that is all we have time for. Big thanks to Ronan Lawler for producing this evening's programme. Big thanks to Laura Lee Davis, who was our broadcast coordinator. Game On is back from 6 o'clock tomorrow. Do stay tuned to 2FM because Beto da Silva is up next with the new music show. But from all of the Game On team, it is. Bye for now.